the podcast that watched Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 36 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm having a second chat with my good friend Mark Denton, who is a brilliantly creative person in every sense of the word. Lives it, breathes it. I don't know if I said this before. If you're lucky enough to go around to his house, you'll see he art directs his house and his clothes and his moustache, like his life, and like every job you might want him to do. I think he's probably the most never-off creative I've ever met in my life. So that's all wonderful. But, you know, if you want to listen to the previous episode, check the SoundCloud channel, and it's in there, and there's lots of great stuff there. But the reason I got in touch with him this time was because I want to do a whole series about the mysterious subject of starting up an agency, partly because I think, you know, when people are into it and they want to get on with it and they know the right numbers, people will generally be pretty generous with their time, and you can take them to lunch and they'll give you all sorts of advice. But I think there's something going on in advertising right now where there's a bit of a level of dissatisfaction with, you know, perhaps the way agencies are going or the way they're set up, or, you know, maybe the whole advertising model is really outdated and we need to give it a bit of a step change. And some of you out there listening to this might think, yeah, absolutely, and I could do that, or I'd like to do that, but I'm not really sure how, or I'd like the basics. So I don't know if I'm going to consistently do it every week, but I'm going to look for people who have started up places and try and get their advice. As you'll discover when you listen to this episode, Mark started up 5 companies of his own, some of them advertising agencies, some of them production companies, but there wasn't really a method to it. And you could say that the lack of method was the method. Anyway, the details are more interesting than that, of course. So without further ado, here's my second chat with Mark. So hi, Mark. Thanks again for joining me. It's very kind of you.
You're welcome, Ben. Happy to be back.
Great. So this is an episode I wanted to do, and I'm going to do a whole series of them, on how to start up some sort of business, whether it's an ad agency or a production company or whatever it happens to be. And as someone I know who's been there and done that in different ways, I thought you'd be a really good first person to talk to about that kind of thing. So with that in mind, what I think would be a really interesting thing for most people would be, could you just tell us, I know you were sort of invited to start Simons Palmer, but maybe you could just tell that story from the very beginning to maybe when you kind of settled in for a few weeks at Simons Palmer.
Well, let's have a think. How far back do you want to go? I got a phone call from this bloke called Paul Simons. I'd never heard of him. Wasn't a singer. It was this bloke who used to work at GGT. And he said, do you want to start up an agency? And before you know it, me and Chris are partners in an agency. It was as simple as that. So there wasn't a lot of thought in it. I could go back further and tell an old story that I told a million times before, where it was predicted that I would be a partner in an agency with Chris by my clairvoyant. So I was expecting the call. I just didn't know who the call was coming.
But there's a sort of little bit where you've skipped it and gone before you knew it. We were sort of an agency. I mean, when you're thinking about what happened with that phone call, are you going, right, let's do it right now. Let's leave our jobs, our safe jobs at Lowe, and just go and start up. And were there not other questions going through your mind? Like, is this the right guy? Should we really be doing this? And stuff.
No, I mean, it's funny you should say that, because they're the questions that I should have been asking myself, but I didn't ask them. That's probably why 6.5 years later, I was out on my arse in the street without an agency.
Well,
so maybe I should have asked some of those questions, but I didn't. I thought, oh, you want to start an agency? Yeah, all right. Where do I sign?
Yeah, and I get that. That's that. I think maybe, I don't know how many people listening to this have just been offered it like you, or other people who have either collaborated with people they knew, so it was a joint decision, or people who have even taken the lead themselves and gone, right, I'm going to do this, I'm going to collect the people involved. Because I'm wondering if that dynamic of Paul calling you up meant that, was he kind of like the boss, the uber boss of your agency once you got going, when the decisions needed to be made?
Well, we're all equal. All five of us were equal partners. So, and from day one, it never felt like he was the boss. So I didn't consider anyone to be the boss, not even me. You know, we were five people in it together. I didn't know the other three too well. I knew Chris pretty well because we worked together for 4 years. It's only four years after we met. It's only a year before that I was a visualiser. So I'd only actually been an art director for 5 years. Chris had only been a copywriter for 3.5 years, I think 4 years maybe. And suddenly we're the creative bosses of an agency. And a brief arrives in front of you and you tackle that problem. I didn't think too much about the mechanics of it. Again, you know, maybe I should have done. Maybe I would have made a little bit more money and maybe I would have had an agency for a little bit longer. But, you know, I didn't ask the sensible questions. I've never asked the sensible questions. I knew what the subject was about before you phoned me up. I knew what you were going to talk about, startups. So, and I thought, what's he ringing me for? Why am I doing this chat? What do I know about startups? And it's only then that I've got a bit of paper out and I worked out that I've actually had five companies.
Yeah.
Five different companies, and I've never really woken up in the morning and think, oh, must have a company. But it's just the way it's worked out. And I've never done it a conventional way, I don't think, insofar as I was going on after Simon's Palmer. Me and Chris had a company together called Spro, and when we worked out that it actually it wasn't quite as efficient to direct as a duo, we went our separate ways. And then I ended up being a partner at Therapy Films with Malcolm Venville, and we owned 50% each. But that just came out of a phone call where Mal literally said, "Here, do you want to come around and be a partner with me?"
Yeah, so... But when you're getting into a business at all, let's go back for a second to Simon's Palmer again and go, so your duties must be somewhat different to Lowe. I'm guessing 90% of it's the same in that you get a brief, you get everything you need to answer that brief. But you're hiring, you're firing, there must be questions about, you know, we'd like to afford this team. Do we have the money for this team? And if they say no, do you go, come on, why are we hiring that account guy when we could be hiring this team and all that kind of stuff? Did those financial questions come up in that way at Simon's Palmer?
Oh, look, all the time, especially early on, because what I didn't realise when we signed up was that we collectively were going to be really crap at new business. And, you know, certainly for the first couple of years, we were rubbish at new business. We couldn't secure any really big clients. You know, we made our great reputation early on the back of luncheon vouchers and slumber down duvets. Yeah, they were our sexy blue chip clients. Greenpeace, we got relatively early on, but they didn't pay us a lot of money. We never started earning money until we got our hands on the likes of BT and Nike, but that was several years into the experiment. I know that my personal brief that I was working to, when I was growing up in advertising, you know, the sexiest agency in town was CDP. And I just thought, right, okay, we've got an agency, I want to be as good as CDP was back in the 70s. That's it, that's my brief. I didn't really share that with the rest of the partners. You know, maybe Chris got an inkling of that, but... the other lot were thinking, right, okay, maybe they were thinking, oh, okay, I've got my eyes on this Rolls Royce over here. Let's try and afford that as soon as we can. And so some of the conversations were probably missed out early on.
Well, that's interesting. It's an interesting question, though. If there's five of you and you have five different things you're aiming for, you're playing five different games, it must be quite, even if it's not apparent at the beginning, you're eventually going to go in five different directions, because it's like, for me, the Rolls Royce is important, right? For me, the prestige is important. For me, the awards are important. Is that where the cracks began to show, or?
Well, it did, you know, it did get get political in the end. Of course, I got fired from my own agency, so of course it got a little bit political. But, you know, maybe there was, you know, there's a lot of things I didn't agree with. But also, you know, obviously I've thought about it a little bit since, not a lot. I don't wake up in a cold sweat in the morning feeling bitter about it. It was a really educational experience. And I think there might have been a little bit of the teenager syndrome going on, where I made myself obnoxious, so I got kicked out. Maybe. Now, like our teenage kids, suddenly yeah. turn off and you can't wait to kick them out the nest because it's time for them to leave the nest.
Yes.
Maybe there was a bit of that going on. I don't know.
I also think that creatives get shielded from the business side of things quite a lot. And I don't know if it's deliberate, and I don't know if it's on the creative's part or the business side of it, people's part. But I think that's quite an interesting thing to happen to a lot of people, because there's so much going on in the side that we're not supposed to look at or that we don't get exposed to. But it's really, really important if you're running an agency. Did you want to get into those questions, or did you think it was like the boring thing that it really wasn't your part of things?
No, I wanted to be as creative as CDP was in the 70s, but I wanted to be a successful business. You know, I wasn't so bloody bonkers that I didn't want to get rewarded at some point for my efforts. So, and being fully aware how poor we were at new business early on, I, you know, me and Chris took an active part in trying to change that, if you like. So it's not like we just sat in our office and said, just give us the creative briefs and you get on with the rest of it. Now, we were very actively involved in trying to change our plot. Because to me, if you're given an advertising brief, you've got to sell a load of baked beans. You do the best ad to sell a load of baked beans. It was an advertising problem. We weren't good at new business, and we needed business. So we applied it, you know, our skills, if you like it was an advertising brief. And we wrote house ads, and I designed a magazine for the agency that we sent out as publicity. And we shot some pilots that ended up us getting some business. So, you know, we were actively involved in that. To a certain extent, of course, there's loads of financial stuff that was going on behind the closed doors that we knew nothing about, because it wasn't our job. You know, it'd have been dull for anyone else to come and say, "Hey, look, give us that layout pad. I'll art direct the next ad." If they're from the finance department.
So what? I think the reason I'm asking is because even if you weren't in the creative department, but you're the finance guy, you might go, why are we spending money on that creative stuff? And if you're the creative guy, you might say to the finance guy, why do we not have enough money to either hire these people or make this little film or make this magazine? So there's a bit of crossover. So
yeah, I suppose there is, but I've always been really resourceful. So I can generally get blood out of a stone. So if there's not a lot of money for promotional stuff, I can enroll people to help me do it. If I'm good at anything, that's probably me superpower. So, you know, I think when me and Chris did add it up, we've done about 2 million quid's worth of pilots. You know, that's 2 million quid's worth of production, and we paid for it for nothing. And this was last century. This was when 2 million quid was a lot of money. I've never had a problem with that. So, as far as promoting the agency, you know, we had a fairly creative reputation early on, despite the very limited resources insofar as a client list. And that was, you know, that's where we applied our skills, if you like, to try to help the business. And it didn't actually cost a great deal of money in the great scheme of things.
So do you think that's what made you better at new business? From if you weren't good at the beginning and then you were good later on, what do you think was the main thing that changed?
Well, I think as we got a great reputation, as it got, you know, and it takes a couple of years, you know, even if you're good, it takes a couple of years to get going. You know, then suddenly we would start appearing on better lists. We would start appearing on lists with clients who had more money to spend. You know, we suddenly we were involved in conversations because someone had heard of us, because of our great reputation. You know, I'm not knocking the other partners insofar as one of the reasons we got a great reputation was that Carl Johnson was the best account man I've ever worked with. You know, he was an amazing salesman. You know, so if early on we did some bad work, it's because me and Chris weren't good enough, not because they failed to sell the good work. Carl could sell almost everything we put in front of him. So it's just the new business thing. It's a different skill. And, you know, from a creative point of view, you know, when creative superstars were important back then, no one had really heard of me and Chris. We'd only just started going. Like I say, Chris had been a dispatch rider 4 years earlier, and I was a visualizer 4.5 years before that.
Right. So the other
did
end
that answer the question, did that answer another question?
Well, it might lead to another one. But I think the other question I'd ask is, agencies very rarely start with five people. Palmer and Denton and Clemo and Johnson and Simons have all gone on to other success elsewhere. Did you all have very defined roles? Obviously, you and Chris were the creative people, but why did you need three other people to start an agency?
I don't know. I didn't know how it worked. This bloke phoned me up and said, do you want to start an agency? You know, there wasn't a lot of deep thinking going on from my end, that's for sure. Oh, agency with your name on it. Oh, that sounds nice.
Yeah.
That was the deep thinking. Where do I sign? I obviously presented myself with Chris in a way that made us look like an attractive proposition because they, you know, the other partners were probably a bit more sensible than us. So they obviously looked at us as an option to start up with and thought we were worth it. So, but deep thinking, forget it. Five people is the way it worked out. I said to Simons early on, I said, look, if you started up and offered me head of art, I would have taken it. And he looked a little bit gutted when he heard that. But it was honest. You know, I had a fifth of the company and I would have gone there for a £5 rise and some furry ties for me, mini.
That is really interesting. And if anyone else listening going, well, surely if I was doing it, I'd go through a more rigorous process or something than that. I can tell you when I was asked to start Luna with Daryl, I think our thinking process was pretty similar in that it was really exciting to be asked to be in charge of like an agency / department / whatever. And, you know, when you're asked to do that and, you know, everything's in place and all you have to do is then turn up and maybe get involved in the other bits of the business, but in general do your job as a creative with no one above you, it is really tempting. And I can see exactly why, you know, you wouldn't ask the questions, because I didn't myself.
Well, the fact is, at that stage I had nothing to lose. I didn't have much of a creative reputation. I'd only just got going. I was a middleweight creative who'd won a few awards, just started to win a few awards. And even if it all went pear-shaped after a year, suddenly I'd be talked about in circles to potential creative directors. This is back when the ECDs were called creative directors.
Yeah.
So, you know, it would have looked pretty good on my CV, even if it all failed in a year. So what did I have to lose? I wasn't earning a lot of money at the time, so it wasn't, you know, I suppose I've never ever got out of bed and thought, I must try to earn a lot of money a day. Be nice, and believe me, I like being rewarded for what I do, but it's never been the number one thing on my agenda. You know, usually I wake up thinking, where can I spend a load of money a day?
And talking of spending money, I think one of the things that happens when you're in charge of an agency is that you are the person who does the hiring and firing and creating the department and that kind of thing. Obviously, it's not part of the business side of it, but I'm just wondering, when suddenly that responsibility is at your feet, did you go, great, I'm going to take this on, there's all these people I've wanted to hire and this is brilliant, or did you feel a bit of a responsibility and did you fire people as well, and what was that like?
Yeah, I did fire a couple of people. I see what it's like. It's not very nice. Not very nice. So that's obviously one of the worst things about the job. But fortunately, it hasn't happened that much. And I say early on, we made loads of mistakes. No one had ever taught me how to be a creative director or manage other people, or I haven't really been taught much at all. I kind of made everything up as I went along. I started as a paste-up artist and became a visualizer. And, you know, then I wanted to be an art director. And that was the next rung. And then you start thinking, oh, well, I'd like to be a creative director or group head. And then, yeah, it would be nice to have your own agency. You know, it's just worked like that. Hiring and firing. The mistakes we made is I thought, right, okay, we need some stars earlier. So despite the fact the agency didn't have much money, we scraped together whatever money we had, and we got a few people in who we paid more than we paid ourselves. And it didn't work out, because obviously once you're a star, you don't want to listen to a couple of newbies, like relative newbies like me and Chris, who wants to listen to us two when we haven't done as much as they have. So that didn't work out. You know, they left after a short amount of time because obviously they didn't like working for us much. But because who wants to listen to us, you know, when we hadn't done as much as them? So after that, we tended to work with cheap creatives who hadn't made it but had loads of potential, because you got more for your money. They listened to you. They were desperate because they hadn't made it, and it all worked out quite well. You know, these relative unknowns like Sean Doyle and Paul Stilben, Tiger Savage, Dave Dye. You know, some of them have done all right, I hear.
They have. I've heard a few of them. And what was the point also where you guys stopped doing the work yourselves and said, right, we're going to get other people in to do this? Because obviously it's cheap.
Never stopped doing the work.
You never stopped.
Nah. We just got too much work for us to do. That's all. Never actually stopped doing the work at any point. And in fact, that was one of the complaints from the management. We were doing too much creative work.
What were they expecting you to do?
Well, you know, that's what I'd say. I'd say, you know, go tell John Egerty or David Abbott that they're fucking the business up.
Yeah. I don't know how much you're allowed to talk about how it came to a conclusion at Simon's Palmer, but were there signs that it was going in the wrong direction that you might not have seen initially because it was your first time round at this thing, kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. After the event, you look at the signs were all over the bloody place. But I say, you know, I have thought about it since, and, you know, I really don't feel any bitterness about it at all, insofar as it was a great learning exercise, it had run its course. For me, it had run its course. It was time for me to do something different. I'd worked with Chris for 10 and a half years, something like that, 10 years, by the time Paul went pear-shaped. It was time for us to do stuff on our own. I loved working with Chris. We had a great creative partnership. Seriously good, and there's many times when I miss it, but it was time for me to go out and do something. And you know, I do this a lot. I can think of many occasions where, even if it looks on the outside that I've made a success of something, I blow it up and start again. I like scaring myself. And I thought it's time. I'd won a lot of awards at Simon's Palmer. The political thing didn't work for me at all. I wasn't happy, and I wanted to try something different as well. You know, and the lure of bucket loads of dosh when we sold out in years to come, you know, maybe it's naive, but it didn't trouble me too much one way or the other.
Right.
And it still, you know, to be honest, it still don't now. I'm really glad it happened like that. I wish I'd been kicked out a year earlier, to be honest. if I think about it. Same as art college. I went to art college, the one art college I could get into, and I stuck with it for 3 years, and I wish the bloody hell they'd turfed me out early on, and I would have probably had a quicker start. You know, I've found things after I've been outside of the agency environment that I didn't know I could do, you know, and this... You know, it's been very exciting since then. But, of course, there's almost nothing I could say. If this is meant to be educational in any way for someone who wants to start up, it's almost like you've got to do the opposite of what I've done throughout my whole career, really, if you want to do, be sensible.
Okay.
It all depends what your agenda is. Why are you interested in starting up? Why would anyone be interested in starting up now? Is it if you've got a bit of paper that says make 10 squillion quid, that's a different brief to create something that is going to be a launch pad to take me on to other interesting creative arenas? Or, deep thinking has never been my strong point, and I've never really thought that hard about anything. Post-rationalisation is almost worthless, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but it's something that goes on a lot in our business, I've noticed, because people like to think that there's a logical process that leads to possibly more emotional decisions. And they like to go, oh, look, well, it was obviously because A happened, then B happened, then C happened, rather than you just went, okay, that feels right, let's go for it and do it. So,
yeah, I don't know whether you've ever had this thought, and I'm sure someone sensible has pointed it out in the past. I've often thought about creative decisions that I've made, and I thought, I wonder where I'd be if I'd done the polar opposite of every decision I've ever made. And I went, down that turning rather than the one on the left. And I think I would have done at least as well, or if not better. You can think too hard, and sometimes if you're any good, sometimes if you're no good as well. But if you're any good, things generally turn out okay. And if you don't worry about what you've got to lose, which I think would stop a lot of people from doing things, when you stop to think about what you could possibly lose, then that will stop you doing something exciting, like setting up a new business. I just think about, what exciting things are going to happen, rather than, oh, bloody hell, what if we fall out and I get fired after 6.5 years? That never bloody occurred to me. I just thought about the potential exciting things that could happen. And I got turfed out, and then lots of very exciting things happened and, launched me into worlds and conversations that I could never imagine having. My advice to anyone who wants to start up is don't think about it too hard.
Just do it.
Yeah, but maybe just do a little bit of research on your partners. See if you're kind of headed over the same hill, or a hill in the same area, rather than completely different hills.
Well, I think that is a really interesting point that you're making, that, whatever reason you're doing it for, is it to make money? Is it to make a reputation? Is it to be the person in charge and not have to have someone you maybe don't respect as much, or you want to go in a different direction creatively? You can hold the reins instead. And having been there, not to the same extent you have, it is really exciting having the freedom to just go, well, there's no one else. It's basically just, do we think this is good? Right. Then it happens. Then it goes out in the real world. And do we want to make that decision? Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. And I think there's, I can't remember who it is who says that autonomy, mastery, and purpose are the three things you want out of what you do in your day. But autonomy, just being able to do your own thing and not have to run it by loads of people and have them crush it or be disappointed by what they said, is really liberating and a great way to spend your day, I think.
Well, do you know what? that's what it's all about, really, for me. I don't like answering to a committee. I've never liked answering to a committee. And I would have paid them money to set up the agency. For just that blank sheet of paper and being the decision maker, so that was a thrill. It was a thrill for the whole 6.5 years that I was there. That's the reason I did it, but genuinely thinking that if you've got a better product, and I really wanted to be as good, the 90s equivalent of CDP, if you've got a better product, then you get a premium price for it. So when you finally do get rewarded for it, you get a good reward for it. So, I wanted to do good work, get famous by doing good work, and at some point in the future get rewarded for it. And to be honest, that really has happened. I've got everything I wanted. insofar as, you know, I left there with a reputation, not maybe not quite as much money as I would have done if I'd hung on for a couple of years, but I left there with a reputation that, that had doors springing open for me all over the world. You know, I've had like a smorgasbord laid before me ever since I left there. It's been great. So I really didn't have anything to lose at all. And even if, you know, even if you saw what happened, or if anyone saw that happened as a failure, I can only ever, it only ever occurs to me as a massive success.
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever see it as a failure, because the work that happened during that time was amazing. And it is interesting also to get your perspective on it having been a great educational experience that then gave you greater standing in the industry. And again, not wanting to in any way compare myself to you, because you took it way, way further and way, way better than I did. But that's absolutely the case. You know, whether something ends up successfully or not, you're always going to learn something from it. And then you'll be able to take that into whatever the next thing is, I guess.
That's what's happened. And of course, you know, I can only say that, and you can only say those flattering things because you're younger than me. So by the time you're my age, you could well have done a lot better.
Cool. Well, just to move on to Bert Sprote, because then you're setting up a company in a very different way to Simons Palmer. First, it's not an ad agency, but then what did you go through to say, right, we now own a company, now we run a company, who do we need to do this with? Or was it just the pair of you?
It was the pair of us, and we had an assistant, and that was it. And effectively, we were represented by Red Wing, shooting TV commercials together, but we were also doing lots of consultancy work for agencies. So that was it, really. You know, I'd worked with Chris for such a long time, and I had such a great time working with him. You know, I could never have wished for a better creative partner. He was bloody phenomenal to work with. It's like the old winning formula. You hang on to it too long, it turns into a losing formula. And shooting other people's commercials ain't the same as coming up with commercials yourself and shooting them. So we found out in a relatively short amount of time that it didn't work for us to be shooting other people's commercials together. So it's a very short-lived company, that. And I found myself out on my own after that, being a commercials director, thinking, blimey, do I really want to do this? And I thought, I'd stick with it just until I work out what I want to do. And here I am, over 20 years later, still doing it. So it must have worked out all right somehow.
Yeah, I think it did. And just on a practical note, and I was going to ask this about when you took on art direction as well as direction later on, and things like Rice Krispie Squares, how do you know what to charge for being a consultant or doing the art direction side of it, or did you not, or was it just part of the package?
Working out how much to charge people.
Well, but for something, you know, there may be a day rate for you as a director, and then you might go, okay, if you want me as a consultant, that's going to cost X and Y. And how do you work out what X and Y is?
Generally, I just make a figure up. I make a figure up based on who's asking me to do what. You know, I'm working directly with the client at the moment who's got bugger all money. I know they've got bugger all money, so I'm charging them bugger all money. But if some big international company says, yeah, I want X, Y, and Z, I think, well, you know, you're buying I wouldn't say a Rolls Royce, but certainly a top end Austin Allegro, yeah, and not a Mini. So you're going to pay Austin Allegro money.
Right.
So, you know, as far as if I've got to go in and style a do a design job and style a big campaign for an agency, then my 40 years experience has got to cost more than your average art director, is the way that I see it.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you're in the world of being a director, you're suddenly back into having a sort of boss again, only in terms of, you know, you want to make these creative decisions, but now there's someone telling you maybe they don't want to go down that path in the same way. Was that, did that feel like it in terms of control, going back a little bit as a kind of backward step, I guess, in terms of being able to be in charge of the whole thing?
Well, the thing about, you know, when someone sends me a script, I've got the option at that point to do it or not do it. you know, and if I meet, well, obviously after I've done a pitch, because no one gets given a job without pitch nowadays, but I've got the choice to pitch for it or not pitch for it. I've generally met the people involved in it. I can see what their intentions are. I can work out whether I can work with them or not, and I can work out whether I'm going to be a valued part of the process rather than someone who just gets told what to do. So I'll make a decision based on that. You know, there are, within my role as a director, there are decisions that are down to me. At the end of the day, you know, whether I was working, there's no agency I could work at now where at some point the client won't be telling me what to do. And that's why I do so many personal projects, is that that gives me the ultimate say. You know, I look inside agencies now, and I look inside creative departments, you know, whether it's at the top or youngsters working in the industry. No one gets the final say now, nobody, from what I can see. So what I got at Simon's Palmer, I don't think exists anymore. You know, me working with Cole Johnson, where in our first year, he only failed to sell one ad in a year. One ad didn't go through the client in a year, and the client had a bloody good reason for turning it down, by the way. So the client was right to turn it down. Where can you go to get that kind of job now? I was just bloody lucky to be in that place at that time with that particular bunch of people. Because later on, we got Mike Perry, who was the account man on Nike, and he was Dan Wrangler, and he was just as good. So, here's the truth. I didn't realise how much I was spoiled at the time. And now, the job that I had then in that agency doesn't exist anymore, because I don't look around seeing any ECDs who had the support that I had. So, being a director, see, the good thing about being a director, generally, all the research, all the arguments, all the meetings have gone on before I get on board. So there's the script, and generally that's what they want. There's the script. We can have loads of arguments about it. Well, they make you do a treatment, so generally people know what they're going to get. So there's probably fewer arguments between directors and the creative team agency client than there are in agencies between the client and the creatives while the work is going through. I'm just making that up.
That makes sense. I think there's a lot of truth in that.
Directing it is good. And do I get a lot of freedom? No, not outside of once the treatment has been accepted.
Right.
But generally, you know, even if we do a lovely cake and I say, yeah, look, I found a cherry to put on top of the cake. Yeah, but it's gone through research and there wasn't any cherries on it. Sometimes the cherries get rejected. So the stuff that you come up with after you've done the treatment ain't quite so popular as it used to be.
Right. Going back into...
does that make sense?
It does, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. It's this whole, are we going to shoot the board thing? But there's less of that sort of 20% to shoot whatever turns up on the day, and let's make it up as we go along.
Yeah, those are lovely, unexpected creative moments that can occur from time to time. They're harder to get them through if a research group in CCUP hasn't signed them off.
Right. So going back to these starting companies or whatever, when Malcolm asked you to join Therapy, did Therapy exist already at that point?
Malcolm had been, I don't know how long Therapy had been going, but Malcolm had this established production company. I think it was him and one other director at the time, so it's only two directors. And I was over at Blink doing pretty well, turning over lots. And he literally just phoned me up and said, look, do you want to come over and be my partner? And because I'd worked with Malk a lot when he was a photographer and we met at Simon's Palmer, I loved working with Malcolm. So, again, there wasn't a lot of deep thinking. I thought, great. I didn't think, oh, wonderful, I'm going to own a bit of a company. I thought, oh, bloody hell, he must rate me. He's given me a lump of his company. And I love working with Mel. What a lovely, creative times we used to have at Simon's Palmer. So it was another one of those where do I sign moments.
So
he never asked for me for any money. he just gave me a lump of the company. Well, he changed hands.
And just out of interest, in terms of owning half a company that already exists, did that all have to go through like a lawyer and a, you know,
bunch of people? Yeah.
And in doing that, we
do it properly.
You do it properly, but was there any back and forth about, so owning half the company, that means you make these decisions, I make those decisions, you own this, I own this. Was that all stuff that came out of that?
Well, I knew that if there was a packet of biscuits in the cupboard, I knew that half of them were his and the other half were mine.
But you had to pay for half of them as well. Oh. Did you have to pay for half the biscuits?
No. Nah. Oh, well, right. I did, you know, once we bought biscuits, yes, but he never, you know, a production company is only worth the people that are in it.
Yeah.
Really. At the moment, Mount was making a profit. It was a well-established production company, but it was a small production company, which was effectively Malcolm. And he was getting more and more, this is the way I remember it, if you talk to him, he might remember it a different way, but he was getting more and more jobs in the States. So, and that was my disappointment, really, because I didn't get to see him as much as I wanted to, because he disappeared to the States. So, effectively, I came into the London office, and I turned over a lot there. So I was making money, he was making money, he was making money for the company, and then we shared the money out. It worked well for everyone. And just because the way I am, and I like chatting to a lot of people, and without a lot of deep thinking, I chat to people and say, oh, bloody hell, come over here. See, I remember, I had me leave, this is a quick example, this is the way I work. There was, I had me leaving party from Blink, I love being at Blink, very supportive company, love working with James, but I had me leaving party, and there was this young director over there called Dougal Wilson, don't know what's happened to him.
No idea.
Young director over there, he brought his flatmate over to my leaving party, he turned up for a drink, Guy Mannering. I'd never met him before, this young bloke who's working over at St. Luke's. And I got chatting to him, and he said, I want to be a director. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm over at St. Luke's. I said, oh, I'll give us a shout when I'm over at Therapy Films. Anyway, he came out to see me. He hadn't done a lot of ads. I don't think he'd made a proper TV commercial. I don't think, but he brought this book of poetry over with some illustrations that he was doing for his then fiance, and he showed me a couple of little videos that he'd done, like a tabletop animation thing that he'd done off his own back, and another little thing he'd done with Dougal. And he had such energy, he was such a creative bloke, I got such a good vibe off him. He had this book of poetry that he was illustrating. I said, right, okay, you know, as soon as I've got a script, I'll get you in here as a director. And before you know it, he's working as a director out of Therapy. You know, that's the way I work. And again, we turned around after a couple of years. It was only when I started there, I was the third director. And we had about 18 directors, I think, and turning over a lot more money. And it just all happened by mistake. And we were doing design jobs, and we relaunched Creative Circle out of Therapy. You know, that was a fun, you know, I've tried to recreate a creative department within a production company. And now people still stop me and talk to me about that now. It was very, very unusual. You know, it's a different kind of company. And that happened only by me not doing a lot of deep thinking. It just happened by me having chats and bringing in a lot of unlikely people, people who had nothing to do with directing commercials. And before you know it, I've got them directing commercials. So, again, another example of no deep thinking and someone ringing me up.
But something.
And me saying, where do I stop?
Yeah, and something successful coming out of it. I mean, I think that's what's really interesting, too. Just to go into the machinery of it again a little bit. So, you bring these all these directors on, and I know from Gabby, having worked in the production side of things, that. You know, sometimes the people who are running the production company are like, well, we don't have someone who does this niche, or we don't have someone who does that niche, or this person can get the script that person's turning down, or whatever. Was there any kind of overall strategy about the directors you were taking on?
Not really. No, there really wasn't any. And, you know, maybe that's why, you know, me and Mel got to a certain stage where we stopped being able to work together because she had an idea of how it should work, and now I had an idea of how it should work. You know, I'd get things, because I try to spread this word when I do my talks about picking up the phone. You know, everyone, you know, it's surprising how many people, certainly in agencies, who never answer the phone. I answer the phone to anyone. And anyone who wants to come around and see me, I see them. So I remember getting a director from a visit from a music company. You know, because this lady from the music company wanted to show me a reel. I looked at it. I said, oh, I like those idents. And they said, she said, that's Sean Desperango. He'd never done any commercials before. And I said, oh, he's bloody good. Yeah, I like that. He comes in for a chat. He's on the roster. I get him a big job for Leo Burnett. It was about $350,000. He'd never done a commercial before. it all worked out rather well. You know, that's the deep thinking that goes on. I just see, oh, I like that. Yeah, oh, yeah, get him in. Oh, yeah, he seems like a nice bloke. Let's see what we can do. I'm still operating like that. You know, I represent four photographers now. I never set myself up as a photography agency. It was someone that was started off with a young photographer coming to see me and saying, oh, will you look at my portfolio? And I started giving them advice. And I said, oh, bollocks, just go sit on my website. And suddenly that has developed into a very, very interesting little project, which is, we got a gallery show at the Jealous Gallery, an art show at the Jealous Gallery, next Thursday, all out and by mistake, all this photographic work up there. You know, we're taking it on to Tokyo afterwards. It's all happened by mistake. It shouldn't have happened. Conversations, phone calls, me chatting to people and saying outrageous things, and before you turn around, something's happened. Yeah. So that's my philosophy on business. Don't think about it too hard. Talk to loads of interesting people. Try things. If it don't work, fold it up and do something else.
That sounds great.
But here I am. Look, I'm 61 this year. It's counter to the laws of advertising, where you fall off the conveyor belt a lot earlier. It's counter to that. I ain't the richest man in advertising. I'm solvent. I do any creative stuff I want to do, and I meet lots of very, very interesting people. I'd love to meet someone who actually was a great businessman who knew really how to monetize what I do. But hey, is that going to happen? I've got between now and 70.
Well, I think it's interesting because I've had conversations with you before where you said, I think it was when you got into doing some design stuff, it was like the most lucrative year you'd ever had, kind of by accident, that you sort of fell into design. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Again, it all happened by mistake. You know, I'm going to try and make this quick. I could make any story long if I put my mind to it, but I'll try and make this quick. So this is what happened. I'm over at Blink. It's just before I leave Blink. James Studholm says to me, look, I've had my new stationery designed. I don't like it much. He said, will you have a go at it? I said, no, I won't have a go at it. Because I did Park Villages and I did a few other production companies. They're the worst clients.
Why?
So, you know, because they're not committees. You know, you've got a director says, oh, I don't like that typeface or that colour shit. They moan about, production companies moan about clients until they are the clients. So I done the government. What a bloody nightmare that was. I resisted it. I did it. And then before you know it, they're changing the bloody typeface and all the rest of it. I thought, well, I don't know any fucking about. I said, okay, James, I'll do it, but only if you give me a completely free hand. And hats off to him, he did. He let me do anything I wanted. At one stage, on his DVDs, I even wrote blinking budgie shit. That's how free a hand he gave me. Best client I've ever worked for. So, again, I'm not a designer. I'm from advertising. Before you know it, that's won the Grand Award for Design at the New York Festivals, which was bigger than Cannes at the time. And it's got gold at Design Week for stationery. And it's got Indian AD for design. And suddenly, I get a phone call from a designer that I'd met. I didn't know much about the world of design, but I met some people from design because of my Knobby Bottom Shuffle exhibition. That's a different story altogether. Anyway, he phoned me up and said, hey, congratulations. I said, what for? He said, well, you're in the top 20 most awarded design companies in the UK in Design Week. I said, "You're joking. I didn't buy Design Week. I didn't bloody know." And I bought myself a copy of Design Week, and they called me Mark Denton Design in this chart. I didn't have a design company. So I thought, well, wouldn't that be funny to try and get Keith Day in the chart? So I opened a company called Mark Denton Design, phoned up the accountant, and I said, "I want to start a new company, Mark Denton Design." I designed a letterhead. I thought, I don't want any clients that are going to interfere too much. So I designed a letterhead that was based on the tailgate of my old man's scrap van and scrap lorry. And I bought myself a library picture of a monkey's arse. I put the two things together. I thought, if that doesn't put people off, convince people that I only want to do the stuff I want to do, then nothing will work for me. And I called myself Mark Denton Design with this identity, had a website, and I made a lot of money on the back. When I finally folded Mark Denton Design, I had a very chunky five-figure lump of money that I put in my back pocket, given that it was just a fun little project on the side. It was good. and that was me setting up a company as a kind of personal hobby stroke joke.
Great.
So it worked out quite well.
Okay. Going back to how therapy parted ways with Malcolm. So how did that come about? Because if you're just directing and he's just directing, what two different ways did you both want the business to take, and why did that not like work with each other?
No, I think the thing, it wasn't just solely the business. He was in America a lot of the time, so I didn't see him. So communication was over a phone. It was not ideal. But, of course, we decided to do some very interesting side projects, like publish a book on Mexican wrestling. And, of course, Val took all the pictures. But I had a lot of skin in it. I had a lot of money in it. And we disagreed about the what we were going to do with that. And I thought, well, I love Malcolm. I love working with him. And I was genuinely touched when he invited me to join his company. It was his company to start with. So touched by that, I thought, well, I don't want to argue with anyone. I could feel the circle of my teenage years dawning on me again. And thinking, well, this has been pretty good. Let's break it up. Break my world up and do something different. I do like smashing things up. And it's generally just as they start bearing fruit. You know, the design thing, I could have stuck with that and I could have turned that into a company, but I didn't. Insofar as I got the juice out of it that I wanted, and then I get seduced by other things. I can start something and then go and see an exhibition about crochet and think, fucking hell, I want to do some crochet. I really fancy doing some crochet. Yeah, I'm going to learn how to do crochet. And I might even start a company where we're crocheting things. And then I'll get fed up with crochet and I'll do something else. I'm no use to anyone. There's no advice that anyone can take from this conversation that will be any good to anybody.
Well, you say that, but I think I'm listening to it going, you know, you follow what you want to do and, you know, you end up as Mark Denton, as you said, still working in advertising beyond the time a lot of people do. You live in a nice house. You've got a good bunch of friends. You've got a great body of work behind you. Where did it all go wrong, I think, as that George Best joke goes. So, you know, people may not be able to take the step-by-step advice and go, yeah, you know, smash it up when it's doing well and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, I think the overall thing of following to some degree your instinct about something you'd like to do and something that interests you, that is good advice.
Yeah, I think I genuinely think if someone is really creative, you can really, you know, as I'm saying this, I surprised myself, actually, because I thought, if you're genuinely creative, you can always find something to support you. And I thought, I often thought, well, if the directing doesn't work out, I never stop having ideas. Whether people like my ideas or not, that's a different matter, but I can't stop myself having ideas. And I thought, I'll just go back into the agency world because, I've got that tap that I can turn on at any point. Now, I've never struggled to get an idea. I've never been frightened by a blank sheet of paper. I've never failed to come up with an idea. I've got total confidence until I lose my marbles that I will always be able to do that. And I thought, right, I'll just go back into agencies if all else fails. And I never realised that the agency world, the advertising world in general, would suddenly stop valuing great ideas. And certainly, that's why I get tempted by more and more things outside of advertising now, because what's happening inside of it ain't quite as creative as it used to be. And, you know, no one wants to pay the right amount of money for great creatives to come in and give them great ideas, because, you know, Martin Sorrell, as I'm not blaming him for anything, I think he's the best salesman in the world. I've got a lot of admiration for Martin Sorrell, because he's sold something to clients that is based around it's big data is more exciting than big ideas. Me being naive, I still think big ideas have got a value, and I never thought that the big idea would lose its value. So that's why I'm getting more engaged with things outside of advertising generally. I can't remember what the question was.
Yeah, me neither.
I can't remember what the day of the week it is. What's going on? What are we talking about?
Well, I actually wanted to go back to Lucha Loco, because you created a book, you created a wrestling event in the Café de Paris, you created a bunch of T-shirts, one of which I seem to remember buying. So when you go, okay, here's a great idea, but how do we get a wrestling ring inside Café de Paris and all this kind of stuff? What do you do to start tackling that kind of thing? Do you have someone else who can fix it all up, or are you going, I don't know, I'm going to ring up a wrestling ring company and see what happens?
Just to make things clear, I can't, left to my own devices, I can't do anything. I can pick up a layout pad, I can pick up my markers, and I can draw stupid pictures. Forget it. Leave me with a computer by myself. All you can ever hope to get is a cleaner computer. I can't do anything outside of pick up a pen and a bit of paper and draw it. But what I'm quite good at doing is enrolling people who do know how to do other things. I want some animation, I'll get a good animator. I want some proper illustrations, I'll get a proper illustrator. For photographers, they come, you know, I get contacted by photographers every week because I could be modest about it, but this is the truth. People stand next to me and do things with me, and it increases the possibility of getting some fame. That, you know, there's too much evidence to deny that that is not a process that goes on. You know, I'm a great talent spotter. I can see people who are just starting the journey. I love them when they stand next to me and we do things together. And I get a buzz out of it. They get a boost to their career. And at the end of it, what comes out at the end of it is a Mexican wrestling book or a Mexican wrestling event or a show at the National Football Museum or any number of any other things that I've done. On paper, you know, where the fuck did this exhibition come from that I'm doing on Thursday? And I do have these fantasies, like I think, oh, right, okay, we've got that now. I'm going to get a film crew down there. I'm going to get some comedy interviewers. And we're going to make a little film and we're going to take it to Tokyo off. Well, I saw this bloke rung me up the other day. He was quite a good cameraman. Let's get him in, see if he'd want to do it. He's only a young bloke. Yeah, and I met this girl who was up in Edinburgh doing a comedy show. She's quite good. I bet she'd make a good interviewer. So I just gather people around me like that, help me do things. And you'd be surprised, the better the idea you got and the more enthusiastic you are about it, people want to jump on board with you. So before you know it, and I don't know how it happens, you've found someone who knows how to nail a wrestling ring together. I've never published a book before. I've never spoken to Italian printers before about putting a book together. But the same way, I'd never spoken to a chocolate manufacturer about making a box of comedy chocolates that I did for Blink when James said, yeah, will you do me a showreel cover? I said, you don't want a showreel, you want a box of comedy chocolates. You're on the phone to, yeah, I'm not on the phone. I said, yeah, phone up a chocolate manufacturer, see if they make some comedy chocolates for me. Here's the drawings. I know how to do the drawings. Yeah, that cost that much. Yeah, James, it cost that much. What do you think? Yeah, well, I would do that. It's as easy as that.
Yeah, I guess
it is. The better idea you've got, with presented with the most enthusiasm, with a trick, you know, fortunately, I've got this bloody big track record. So if anyone, so I don't even have to phone anyone. I've got these young photographers or illustrators or these people who want to do things keep fucking nudging me and saying, oh, can we do something together? And I'm clever, but I am not so clever that I can supply all of the hungry mouths that are open in front of me. It's that easy. Yeah, you know, stop thinking too hard and stop trying to do it all yourself is my advice I'd give anyone. You know, surround yourself with loads of talented people who can make you look good. Bloody easy.
Absolutely. And talking of which, after the therapy, there was Koi, and that was your own production company. So yeah. was that, did you view that differently in terms of a chance to do things that were different to therapy? Or was it just an extension of what you'd been doing, but you on your own?
No, do you know, again, I decided to leave therapy and do something else. I thought, I genuinely want to do something else. I don't know what it is. And it was my producer, Sarah, who said, look, come and go out for a cup of coffee. She said, look, do you want to start another production company? I said, no, I don't. I've done that. I like directing. I want to continue directing, but I want to try some other stuff. And, you know, at the end of the cup of coffee, I thought, fuck it, let's do it. You know, all right then. And we did it, and I used, you know, the thing about a winning formula, it's very dangerous winning formula because there's at some point, because all you can ever expect and know that is a certainty is change. The industry changed. I had a winning formula over therapy. We did do bloody well. You know, after I turned up, our turnover went up an enormous amount. And, you know, we all made lots of money, and I really could talk jobs in for people who had never done it before. I love selling myself. I really love it. And so I applied exactly the same formula for Koi. And, of course, the formula didn't fucking work anymore when the recession hit, because it all became about price and not creativity. And, you know, because I'm stubborn, I thought, right, I'm going to still keep flogging this horse. And I didn't realise it was dead. So it took me, you know, at least half a dozen years to fucking get it that actually the old model of a production company in the way that I could make it work didn't exist anymore. There's cleverer people than me that have stuck with it and made it work. So, you know, as you know, Koi still exists. But it ain't a production company anymore. I still direct commercials. But I do that through Thomas Thomas because they're better at producing TV commercials than I am. And the thing about having Koi as a production company was that I was taking on jobs that I didn't want to do just to pay the overhead. So it was unfair on the people that I was taking the jobs from because I didn't like some of the jobs that I did. So you would have been better off with someone who liked them. Now, if I take on a directing job, it's because I like the script and I like the people and it's not because I have to pay the overhead. The other creative jobs that we do are solely because I like doing them. I've got to an age now where I don't want to do anything I don't want to do. And I'm fortunate enough, and it is only fortunate, because I was in advertising at the right time and I earned some money. I couldn't do it now because no one wants to pay for creativity like they used to in the old days. So all that is a bit of talent and a lot of luck just to be born in the right age. So now I do what I want to do. I still surround myself with enthusiastic, young, creative people who want to go somewhere because it is like attaching jump leads to your testicles. I get a lot out of it and they get a bit out of it and we do a load of stuff and some of it makes money and some of it don't and it don't bloody matter. I'm having fun and I used to like advertising, so I keep hatching these plans of trying to revive me old mate advertising and try and get a bit more creative and try and get a bit more creative with advertising because, you know, I grew up on it and I love doing it and I still like bits of it. And I haven't quite given up yet. I have got a few advertising-y plans that I'm just about to put into place that just might, I thought, lead by example, you know, don't moan about the fact that work is not quite as good as it used to be. Lead by example, do some different stuff.
That's absolutely, I think, the best way to go.
Are we into the second hour yet?
We're into second hour. I was going to say that because we've gone through most of what you've done, and I'm going to try and put this up, if not today, then tomorrow, unless something weird happens. I wondered if you wanted to finish off by plugging your exhibition and anything else you've got coming up, because it's going to be the right time to say it.
Well, I have got this exhibition at the Jealous Gallery on Thursday, and I've got to say thank you to Dave Bonaguidi, because without him, it wouldn't have happened. And then, so God knows what's going to happen after this. But I'm fluffing it up in a way that I could take it somewhere else. And, you know, Tokyo's my target. So I'll let you know how that goes. If anyone's got any ideas on that front, then please get in touch. You know, I'll pick the phone up. And I'm doing another thing with the Fresh Awards. Now, not many people have heard the Fresh Awards. And everyone's fed up with awards now. I know it's a different conversation with, you know, at the same time, I'm fed up with awards. But I've got an idea. I've got an idea of how I can help that be a little bit alternative and interesting to the shit situation with awards at the moment. So I've got that. A few other bits and pieces that I'm sure people will be seeing in the future. But if anyone's got any ideas of doing anything, or if they want to tap into you know, the way that I work, just phone me up and we'll see if we can stir things up a little bit. But first of all, turn up on Thursday, buy some art if you want to. Just turn up and get pissed if you don't want to buy any art. And I'll let everyone know what happens next.
That's great. And I'll just say to anyone who's listening to this going, shall I turn up? Because Thursday there's something else like on TV or whatever. What I'd say is go and turn up, because when I got into Mark's orbit, when I got into your orbit, I don't know if I'm talking to the people listening or I'm talking to you, the energy that you've got, that it's both addictive and inspiring, and you kind of go, look, Mark's doing all this. How can I not match him or try and like get up to where he's going and come along for the ride? So if you're just going, oh, I don't know what I'm doing, where I'm going next, go along to that gallery on Thursday, go and meet Mark and try and get in his orbit somehow, and things will improve.
Ben, you're a flatterer. You stay in my orbit as long as you like.
Well, it's been great spending another hour in it, because obviously being in different countries, we don't spend as much time in each other's orbit as we'd like to. But I'm always watching what you're doing, and it's always fantastic. So it's been great to have another hour of your excellent advice and charming stories.
Cheers, Ben.
Okay.
See you soon, hopefully, and good luck with your next project.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
If this is a podcast, then watch Christmas.